Welcome to UK Health Radio. You are listening to the Speech and Language Therapy Show, hosted by Shamina Rabi, a consultant speech and language therapist and founder of Unlocking Language, an award-winning independent practice that provides speech and language therapy to both adults and children. She is dedicated to raising awareness about speech, language, communication and swallowing difficulties and empowering those who have them.
Hello, welcome to the Speech and Language Therapy Show on UK Health Radio, your Goodfield global radio station. This is Shamina, your host for today. I hope you are well, I hope you are healthy, and I hope you are safe. I'm very excited to say that we have a fantastic guest on our show today, Anna Volkmer, who is a speech and language therapist working with adults with acquired communication difficulties, in particular adults who have dementia. And she's going to talk to us about how we can continue providing speech and language therapy in the midst of what is going on. So today on the show, we have Anna Volkmer, a speech and language therapist who specializes in people with dementia, with a particular interest in working with people with language-led dementia, also known as primary progressive aphasia. Anna has also written a book on the assessment and management of language and cognition in progressive communication disorders, and currently works as a senior speech and language therapist at the National Cognitive Disorder Service at Queen's Square, and as a senior lecturer in the Department of Language and Cognition at UCL. Anna is also part of the team that leads the primary progressive aphasia branch of the Rare Dementia Support Group at UCL, and excitingly has just completed her PhD subject to minor amendments, Sinili, Dr. Anna Volkmer. And alongside this work, Anna has developed an interest in the role of the speech and language therapist in supported decision making and mental capacity. Welcome, Anna. That's superly impressive.
thank you for that lovely welcome.
So thanks for coming on the show today. It's really exciting because I think, you know, for speech and language therapists, it's a very challenging, unusual but exciting time, and what I'm trying to do over the next few weeks is support our profession by having expert therapists come in and talk about what they do and give some tips and some words of wisdom around what we're all trying to do, which is teletherapy or get to our patients somehow.
Sounds like a fantastic plan.
So tell us more about yourself. Talk us through your journey of being a speech and language therapist.
So I graduated from UCL back in 2002, having done my undergraduate degree in speech and language therapy. So it's a little while ago now. And I've worked clinically only with adults across the UK, around in London and the surrounds, all with adults. And then I moved to Australia and worked there for 5 years. Of course, in Australia, they have very remote and rural areas. So telehealth was already on my radar there, as many of the speech and language therapists working rurally don't have the breadth of expertise. And they had set up a number of telehealth services for more specialist interventions, such as even laryngectomy management, although I was never personally involved with that kind of intervention. But then I came back to the UK in 2010, and I worked clinically again, initially working at South London and the Maudsley, and that's when I started so it was actually in Australia I became particularly interested in working with people with language-led dementia. And when I came back to the UK, I kind of figured that London might be doing more than I thought they were. And when I came back, I thought, actually, given that the speech therapists here were also struggling with this client group, dementia, I decided to write this resource. Having written this book, I really recognised that there was a gap in the research literature for people with primary progressive aphasia, and that the majority of research literature there focused on word relearning therapies, which wasn't always meeting the needs of the people I was working with. And I was using more communication partner training interventions for which there wasn't much research underpinning practice. So that's what inspired me to do a PhD. So my PhD focused on communication partner training intervention. So we actually developed an intervention based around the better conversations with aphasia intervention, which is been developed by Dr. Suzanne Beacon and colleagues at UCL. But we refined it with working with people with PPA and their families. So we co-produced a lot of it. And informed by some other research, so I did a UK-wide survey of speech therapists and a systematic review. And then we actually piloted the intervention. So we called it Better Conversations with PPA. And we piloted it, or it's still being piloted, across 11 NHS sites. So 31 speech therapists were trained. So far, we had recruited 20 participants from a pool of almost 60.
Okay. But
unfortunately, of course, we've had to interrupt all that research for now. So we've had to withdraw a few participants. And so my next steps, I've actually just last week had my Viva. Yesterday. It feels like last week, it would say.
I think in lockdown, we're getting lost in our days.
Exactly. So I had my Viva and I have to do some minor amendments, which is the best outcome. That's the outcome that the majority of PhD Vivas have. So I'm really pleased with that. And just got a couple of small amendments to make to my thesis. And I'm currently in the process of applying for more awards and grants to continue my research career. But I'm also working clinically again back at the National at Queen Square. And given that I see people there who have dementia, have language-led dementia, and they come there from across the UK, we were exploring some telehealth options anyway.
Okay.
Because, for a person with dementia to travel from Devon up to London is a real challenge.
That's tricky.
It's a challenge for anybody to travel that far. So we've been starting to explore this anyway, but given the current crisis, we've really plunged in.
Yeah, absolutely. So just before we plunge into teletherapy and sort of seeing how you've been doing it, can you tell us a bit more about what primary progressive aphasia is? Because as speech therapists, yes, we know aphasia, we know Broca's aphasia, we know receptive and expressive aphasia, but primary progressive aphasia, I often see speech therapists going, ooh, need help. So can you explain what it is and what are the stats around that in the UK?
Absolutely. So primary progressive aphasia is a language-led dementia. So I often describe dementias as being language-led because the atrophy starts in the left brain regions, if you will. Mm-hmm. Whereas if a dementia starts in the right hemisphere, we call it a memory-led dementia because it's predominantly memory symptoms. Whereas if you have a dementia that starts in the frontal areas of the brain, it's most commonly a behavior-led dementia because the first symptoms are behavior. And then if it starts in the back of your brain, it's a more visual-led dementia, perceptual-led dementia. So if it's a language-led dementia, essentially language is the first or the most significant symptom impacting on activities of daily living. It's called primary progressive aphasia, and there are three types. So there's a logopenic type, a semantic type, and a non-fluent type. And then those people present a little like post-stroke aphasia, where we have these categories like Broca's and Wernicke's. People present with specific language profiles. In terms of prevalence, going back to that aspect of the question, so we know it's really hard to put our finger on. We're not sure, but we are certainly sure that it's underdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. So there was some research done in Cambridgeshire looking at, so they looked at So PPA has a number of types of primary progressive aphasia, or PPA, I'm going to call it that now.
Yep, PPA.
It slips off the tongue more easily. A number of types of PPA are associated with an underlying frontotemporal dementia pathology. So the actual protein that causes the dementia is related to a frontotemporal dementia, right? So there was some work done on frontotemporal dementias, and they work with that work were, we have been able to calculate that there's probably at least 3,000 people living with the those types of PPA, but that probably only accounts for about 2/3 of PPAs, because one type of PPA, and actually probably the most common, is associated with an underlying Alzheimer's pathology.
Oh,
and the other thing to say is that these types of PPA are really hard to diagnose. So in older people in particular with comorbidities, and with younger people, it's often misdiagnosed as psychiatric issues. So my feeling is the number of people living with PPA is much higher. A lot of speech and language therapists do express some concern about working with this client group. So, mm-hmm. And I'm glad you raised that, Jamina, because actually, it's not rocket science. It's a lot of what we know already, and I actually don't necessarily feel that the model I just described of people having said being three variants of PPA is necessarily that useful for us. But approaching this group with that kind of old strengths and difficulties based approach that we use in aphasia, you know, the idea of just assessing somebody or getting to know somebody and identifying what areas of language and communication are difficult and what are their strengths, that's what bodes well in terms of being able to plan an intervention. And in terms of intervention, people are borrowing from, there is a burgeoning developing research literature in this area on interventions, and I've published a couple of articles, one of which is a systematic review of functional communication interventions in this area.
Okay.
But actually many of the interventions are borrowed from the stroke aphasia literature and have been modified to meet the needs of people with PPA. And certainly the communication partner training work that I've developed, I developed it on the basis that when I did a UK-wide survey of speech and language therapists, I found that those therapists who were working with PPA were preferencing communication partner training and were actually using resources from the stroke literature. So stroke aphasia literature says things like Better Conversations and Spark, and they were using those kind of resources. And so what we've done is we've taken them as a kind of model, but actually we've co-produced, we've worked with people with PPA, we've worked with their families, and we've worked with speech and language therapists in this area to refine that intervention to make sure it meets the needs. And I guess one of the key points here is that it's a progressive condition. So for many people, when you're delivering interventions in aphasia, you're working on rehabilitating people to an improvement.
Yeah, and then maintaining it. Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas in this, you're kind of working on exercises that the aim of them is to maintain their language. But actually with communication partner training, we're also not only working on their strategies, we're also working on their partners, who I guess they're a really good investment, you know, your future-proofing, because they're not going to change, hopefully.
Yeah, and as the patient does deteriorate with their language skills, do you then get involved again and change the strategies of the communication partner or with the communication partner?
Yeah, I guess I always anticipate that these are a kind of client group who will dip in and out of services. So they will have a block of therapy and then another block of therapy later on. You know, many people I work with will actually start off working on impairment-based therapies often at the beginning of their journey, and they might work on those for a long time, so word relearning or word maintenance exercises, and that works really well for them. But for some people, there comes a point where they just cannot be bothered with continuing those. Other things become more of a priority, at which pace switching pace is valuable. So they might want to explore alternative therapies, as in communication partner training or communication aids. They're the kind of major two other areas. So yeah, I think it's really important as people progress that they keep reviewing what works for them and having the opportunity to, through a person-centered focus to therapy, have the opportunity to explore other therapies to maximise their quality of life and their independence.
So are you now doing this via teletherapy?
Yes.
And how's that going?
Yes, is the short answer. So it's actually going, I'm finding it really fantastic.
Okay, that's good to know.
It's a bit tricky with this particular client group because many of them are a bit older, many of them are not. So especially the language-led dementias are often diagnosed when people are still in their 50s and 60s. But we also work with people. I was on a call with somebody, a virtual call with somebody who was in his 80s, late 80s, just recently. So it depends what the technology they have available at their fingertips. And of course, some of these people do have technology set up. You know, lots of these people have grandkids and they FaceTime and WhatsApp with their grandkids. So some of them are well-versed, but others are not. But I would say generally, before the current situation, some of those people were then able to get relatives or friends to come in and support them to set up what they needed. Unfortunately, that's, of course, another limitation of the current situation. The people I work with cannot.
Well, everyone's socially distancing and isolating. Yeah, absolutely. So
they can't.
I was thinking about the barriers and challenges of doing teletherapy with adults, in particular an older group. So, what happens in the case where they don't know how to use technology? And that may be the case for many adults who have got communication disorders and are self-isolating.
Absolutely. Well, in those cases, up until now, I've been using telephone calls instead. But I know that our service are working on a method of doing virtual calls that doesn't require the other person to do anything. They need to have a laptop or a smart technology phone or something, but they don't need to necessarily, download an app.
Okay.
But that hasn't happened. That hasn't been set up yet.
And would you be able to see them as well and they could see you, or would they just be able to see you?
I think that's the intention.
Okay.
But that hasn't unfortunately been set up yet. So actually I've been doing some work on the phone with people and I'm surprised how effectively even that is. And when people are highly motivated, they're very happy to talk on the phone. And I've been doing speakers. If you put the speaker on a phone, you can still have a three-way conversation. And that's been very helpful. So, and some of my the people I work with non-fluent variant primary progressive aphasia actually report that talking on the phone is easier than talking face to face. So they feel that they're more fluent, which
that's
is interesting.
Interesting.
So, indeed, and so they're quite happy to speak on the phone. Some of those individuals, but one of the advantages I have to say, which I did not anticipate necessarily. Had I thought about it more, it should have been more obvious, but I deliver an outpatient service routinely. So people are coming in to see me, traveling, as I mentioned, from all over the country. But given this remote technology, people don't have to travel so far, so they're not as tired, but B, they're set up in their own homes. So there's some people I'd started working with face-to-face in outpatients, and then I moved it to virtual telehealth, and I saw I was given an insight into their communication in their own home, and it actually gave me a really useful insight, and it allowed me to see many of their communication strengths that I hadn't previously. So the person with aphasia with PPA was able to take the device, the laptop or the phone, and say, show me their front garden and the bits in their garden that they love, their bird feeder or their shed or their plants, or photos of their relatives. They were able to,
And that's great because therapy becomes more functional and meaningful as well. There's probably a lot more output from the patient.
Absolutely. More output, more. So there was a few of the couples I was working with when I worked with them together on the through telehealth and we were doing communication partner training. I actually got to see their kind of natural conversational style between them more. They're in their own home. They were the partner with PPA was often making more jokes, more relaxed, more you could actually see the roles that they take up in their conversational relationship. Yeah, it was really, really helpful.
Great. So I mean, those are some really positive benefits around us trying to deliver telehealth to the adults. So where can speech therapists start? For the speech therapist that is thinking, oh, I've got an adult caseload, or I'm in outpatients, you know, in the NHS or privately, where could they start? How could they start off? What could they be doing or thinking about?
So I think one of the things to consider, of course, is safety. So for yourself and for your clients and that you're working with, and using a medium that is safe is really important. That said, for many of the people I work with, for our older people, they may not have the luxury of selecting between, you know, Teams or Skype or WhatsApp or Zoom. They may not have the luxury of doing that. They may only have one method that they're familiar with. So in that case, it may be, especially at these times, considering that many of these people are self-isolating, is choosing not necessarily to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't do that with you because it's only on FaceTime and that's not the safest medium, but actually making people aware of the perhaps of those safety issues might be a way of getting around that. So if people understand that you are happy to speak with them by that medium, but there may be some limitations or safety issues, or yeah, it might not be quite as confidential as, say, seeing somebody in person, and that person consents and understands and is able to make an informed decision to continue to participate in therapy despite those limitations, then I believe it's quite appropriate to go ahead rather than leaving them isolated at home. So many of these people are at the moment not seeing anybody else.
Yeah, that's such many a concern about their mental health and how they're feeling.
Exactly. And whether they even understand the risks. You know, some of the people I've spoken to, their relatives have said, I'm trying to tell my partner what this means, what this all, what the impact is, what all the precautions we need to take, and I'm really struggling. So actually, you know, having a health professional available to actually support the partner and support the family and explaining it, even sending them resources by email.
And there's some fantastic resources out there that lots of therapists have made. I've seen lots of tweets about aphasia-friendly and communication-friendly resources. And I think you've made a really good point for health professional or the speech therapist supporting that conversation. And when you are having that discussion with the client that this is what we would like to do, are you having it with the client and the partner? And and obviously you said it's quite important to be transparent with them. Is there anything else you do, a sort of checklist when you're preparing or discussing let's trial teletherapy?
I think the key things are, at the client-facing point, yes, I would go through that. I would also, establishing common ground and saying, this is what modality are we going to use then? To get some clarification before the appointment, so otherwise you know so that both people at both ends of the line are expecting the call in the same medium. You don't want one person expecting a phone call and the other person and you're about to WhatsApp them. Just
sure.
That creates confusion. So making sure that you're all on the same page, clarifying what you're going to do, how long it's going to take, some of it is just routine. What the aim of the session is, making sure that both participants are there, so that I have found on one or two occasions the communication partner hasn't realised that this was for both them and the partner. So sometimes they just remained on the line. But actually stepping back a bit and also looking more at the service, it's really important to have a protocol in place. I guess I always forget that word that you have when for all your things in your service, a SOP, a...
we've both got word-finding difficulties right now.
So very true. But you know, having a so that you've got a policy, that's the word I'm looking
okay,
for.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, a policy in your department, so that takes that into consideration. So looking, so in our organisation, there are, we have some overarching policies, but then we've also developed our own policy. And that policy has been guided by the safety and risk management policies from the in the entire organisation. It's also based on the research evidence underpinning teletherapy with the client groups we work with, so which have some guidance on whether this is even feasible or valid. So to make sure actually that we're delivering an evidence-based service, that we are not that we're thinking about that still, even when we're delivering these interventions and assessments in a non-traditional way. There's lots of research that actually underpins telehealth,
and it has been going on for quite a while, because RCSLT there's a core group working on updating the teletherapy policy and making it more meaningful in this current climate. We've been exploring, looking at research, and there's been research going on for several years now around teletherapy and the efficacy and efficiency in aphasia, in early intervention with toddlers, across the spectrum, really.
Absolutely. And you and I were talking very briefly about this yesterday. There's a study of looking at teletherapy in primary progressive aphasia. There's a number of studies looking at it, and what they've actually looked at is the outcomes. So they've compared outcomes from teletherapy with outcomes from face-to-face therapy, for specifically for word and relearning therapies, so those word maintenance therapies. And they found that they no matter the modality, the outcomes were equal. So what they've started doing, so it's a group over in the States led by a speech and language therapy researcher called Maya Henry at the University of Texas, Austin. And they've actually started doing trials, their research trials, and they're including people having their interventions delivered both face-to-face and through teletherapy, and they're just including them both in the same pool. So they're not differentiating between them, and they're doing that on the basis of this idea that actually the outcomes are the same.
Isn't that interesting? Because you kind of think face-to-face, you know, will definitely have more value. So it's good to know where we are at this point, that actually it will work. And then once you've had that call with the patient and the partner, do you follow it up with anything in anything written? So do you send an email outlining, or do you send I'm assuming you send a consent form then?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly, so that's a really good point about the consent form. And actually, the other thing I offer, it depends. Some people still don't necessarily use email. They may use email, but they may not have a printer at home.
Yeah.
And they may not, especially at the moment, they may rely on another family member for printing who's not able to do that for them because of self-isolation. So I also always try to send people a summary or some materials to get on with home-based activities. And I've been sending people links to resources that explain COVID, like you say. And actually, I went to a mental capacity webinar. I participated in one virtually just last Wednesday. And it was hosted by the Mental Capacity Forum, hosted by Baroness Finlay, and she has been one of the individuals who's really pushed the government to consider the mental capacity issues. In fact, she was the one who it was her and her group who really got the Mental Capacity Act and the code of practice going and all of that. So, and it's a forum with social workers and all different professionals in it. And they've one of the resources they recommended is something called Beyond Words, and which has a non-verbal so it's a story, an illustrated social story, and they have a number of versions of it that illustrates the impact of COVID, but also the strategies you should take to guard against COVID. And so they've actually recommended it. So that's one of the most common resources I'm using because of the legislative underpinning and the support that they've given that. Because I think one of the real concerns is that we are not, you know, the Mental Capacity Act still stands, even in these
absolutely
times. And I think that sometimes there's been some concerns that people are being deprived of their liberties more than they should be, because of COVID, or that Mental Capacity Act kind of consent decisions and capacity assessments aren't being undertaken because of COVID, that they're being not done at all, or they're just being done in a very tokenistic fashion.
Sadly not being prioritised.
prioritised. And so one of the things they've been advocating, and I think this is another really exciting suggestion, is that we should be doing those, we can do those remotely. And so what they're saying is that many of the people who are doing capacity assessments to reduce footfall are not going into nursing homes and not going into hospital wards and not going into people's homes, but are trying to do it remotely via video conferencing. So handing people, getting staff on wards to use iPads and iPhones or even the person's own devices, allowing teams to do mental capacity assessments through that medium. So I would also say to the speech and language therapy community to not hesitate to get involved with that side as well, because we have a really important role in mental capacity and decision making. And given that they've advocated this remote model of working here in this area too, then we can be part of that too.
Oh, that's brilliant, Anna. And you touched on resources, so beyond words, are there any other resources that you've been using? Are they interactive, or does it work better with your client group when you either email them or send them? And how are you doing assessment?
So yeah, I mean, as you probably know, the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapy are doing a great job at bringing together a resource page for speech and language therapists with links to lots of different resources that are being developed across the world. And so I would always recommend, if people want a range of resources, to go to that website, the World College website. And they're updating it continuously. And there's aphasia-specific ones. There's learning difficulty-specific ones. There's children-specific.
Every autism. Population, every condition, yeah.
Every client group. So it's a really helpful resource, and I've gone there to look for some resources as in myself. One of the things I have been also doing is actually a common issue for people with dementia is actually that I'm finding a common issue for the people I'm working with is that with language-led dementia, people are often quite mobile still, that it's just their cognition and their communication that's difficult. They're often quite orientated. So many of the clients I work with will have a daily routine of going out to cafes or taking buses. Mm-hmm. And it's part of maintaining a rigid routine that allows them to function. It provides independence. And unfortunately, that isn't what they're supposed to be doing at the moment. And so there's been some issues around that. So where there's been some risk issues and those people are still going out, one of the things I've often been doing is actually been giving carers kind of communication cards to tuck into their loved one's pockets, and letters where they a few of the carers have had to go out and where they wouldn't necessarily wanted to do things related to the care for their loved ones. So giving the carers letters stating that they've had to go out so that they feel that they've got that resource there in case somebody approaches them and questions what they're up to. And the other thing to say is that I'm often sending people links. So the Rare Dementia Support Group at UCL has, so I'm involved with a PPA branch, but they have a number of different branches, including early onset Alzheimer's, frontotemporal dementia, and they have on their website incorporated lots of resources there So some emergency packs for people, emergency guidance, but also activities. So they're making loads of videos, not only about what PPA is, but also kind of leisure, kind of interesting things for people to be able to engage with at home. So I've done a bit of work in terms of just pointing people towards things that will be interesting and helpful. So many of the people I work with, I mentioned this routine thing and maintenance of independence, and often it's based around them going to an art group and a tennis group or something, and those, or a singing group, and they're disappearing. So sending them to the online versions of those things gives them some ability to continue to participate in activities that they enjoy and that maximise their quality of life.
Absolutely, keep them engaged, give them opportunities for communication. Brilliant. Yeah. So those are some really useful resources. And just quickly going back on, how can therapists, I mean, have you done any assessment on teletherapy?
Absolutely.
Also, I think you said that you did some swallowing, some dysphagia assessments as well.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't answer that in your last question.
That's okay.
I would say the work I've done, I have done some language assessments. I've also done some swallowing assessments. I've also done some communication partner training where I've shared videos with people via video conferencing. So videos of conversations that they've been having as we've been doing it.
And you're watching it together so they can see the same screen.
Absolutely. Okay. So we're watching it together so they can see the screen. So with the language assessments and the watching the videos together, and there are some, so I have done it in different ways. So one of the very simple ways I've done it is held up the comprehensive aphasia test pages to the screen, and people are able to participate in that. I know that that we've also been able to use the online an online version where we can, so we can split the screen, okay? And and in terms of the videoing, also splitting the screen is helpful.
Okay.
That's been really helpful. Or having two devices. So it's a little bit of fumbling around at the moment. I think that technology, I think as we get more used to and develop that technology, and as the technology gets set up by the trust, we will be able to do more split screen work. I think split screen is really helpful because that's just presenting materials to the person like you would do on a desk in a therapy session. The other thing to say is in terms of swallow assessments, what I have done is watched people having food and drink virtually, and that's been, although odd, it's been totally fine. I haven't done any, because of the nature of my caseload, the evidence around doing kind of an oromotor exam is lesser. I have done the odd kind of oromotor exam to accompany my dysphagia assessment, but most commonly I would just I've just watched them have some food and drink and been able to glean very really helpful information, probably as helpful as me giving them a cup of water and a biscuit in an outpatient setting, if I'm honest.
I agree with you. I think you and I were talking about this because I did some swallow assessments and have continued to review them via video. And at first it does feel strange because as speech therapists, we are very hands-on. But then I think as the assessment goes on, you quickly forget and you just get into assessment mode.
I do.
I mean, the only thing is, you can't palpitate the larynx, but I think we were both discussing that, there is some evidence now that says you don't even need to necessarily do that. I mean, I have got the nurse to feel it and just to tell me whether, it felt strong or weak. And I've added that in my notes. And in terms of your notes now, is your record keeping as it was before or have you had to alter that?
No, our record keeping is as it was before.
Okay.
I guess that might vary for other organisations and the way, and maybe if people working more independently, but certainly within the health, within the trust that I work in, we're recording sessions in the exact same way. Yeah.
And have you had anyone where you've done a swallow assessment and thought they may need thickened fluids, but of course there's no thickener on that side of the screen. I've not got to that. Well, I have. I'm in the hospital. I've been doing my reviews in the hospital, so they do have thickener available. Have you had that? Has that come up yet?
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. It actually came up earlier this week. And so not so much that, I mean, I probably if that person had been in a clinical setting, I would have considered trialing them on thickened fluids just to see how they got on with it. But actually, I probably wouldn't have recommended it for this individual. I think probably with the caseloads that I work with, the idea of thickening somebody's drink is quite a big decision because they are progressive. So you are really, it's not like you're going to thicken their fluids and then maybe take them off it again. And it's quite a big decision. So in this particular case, I am going to refer them to local service because actually I probably would have done anyway because of their underlying pathology also having lots of other motor implications. So in terms of their potentially with walking and mobility and everything. So we would have linked them in with their local specialist service. So in that respect, I'm not too concerned, but I agree. I think it would be more challenging if you were working with a more acutely unwell caseload where you would potentially put the trial thickener and put them on thickener and then withdraw, you know, that kind
of,
you
absolutely. Know, or if they do need the thickener, but of course they don't have any thickener at home. We did have an instance where the nurse had forgotten to bring the thickener tub and then was ordering it from pharmacy. And so in that case, I asked her, can you trial the patient on yogurt, just so I could see the discrepancy from thin fluids to yogurt. And then he managed quite well on yogurt. So I thought, okay, he probably will manage on thickener, but I'll assess that when the thickener arrives. But that's something I guess, you know, speech therapists can do or if there are any ready-made thick drinks at home. And again, it's about having that pre-assessment discussion with the partner that these are all the things that we will require for the assessment, and then I often will just email it through that please have these things ready rather than everyone frantically running around to try and find everything during the assessment. And can I ask what platform are you using for your telehealth?
We're using whatever platform the person themselves can manage at the moment. And as I think I mentioned initially that some of the people I work with use FaceTime to see their grandkids.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm using everything from FaceTime to Skype to Zoom. Although Zoom, I have to say there have been some recent articles about the safety, the risks on Zoom.
I think they've just increased their security measures this week. But yeah, I agree with you. And what is the most popular platform then amongst your caseload?
So amongst my caseload, the most popular platform is probably WhatsApp or Skype.
Okay.
They're the two I'm finding that people are most keen on. So that's fairly easy to facilitate.
Good. Okay. That's useful to know. So it's been brilliant having you on, Anna. You know, it's been great to sort of get the perspective of how speech therapists can continue with what they're doing with the adult population with acquired communication disorders. Any final words of wisdom?
I guess the thing I would say is that I believe that working with people in the community is still a frontline job for speech and language therapists at the moment in the current COVID crisis, because many of the people we are working with are self-isolating, are at risk. You know, their dysphagia puts them, if they've got dysphagia, puts them massively at risk. Their age often puts them at risk.
Absolutely.
Their underlying health conditions put them massively at risk. Their communication difficulties put them and their families at risk. And I think this is still frontline work to maintain their mental health, their independence, their health, their physical health, and also to, you know, to this, for many of these people, this is their, is a key period in their lives anyway, you know, if their disease is progressing, or if we're looking at a stroke population, you know, if they, if these people don't, or a brain injury population, if these people don't receive our services, they're going to miss out on vital rehabilitation and support. So I actually think, I would stress actually that this is still frontline work. And then the other tip I would give is that if you're a bit reticent about delivering teletherapy, is jump in and have a go. I think it's like many other things. Yeah, absolutely. If you, many of the people I've worked with, as I said, even in their 80s, have been finding it telling us. I've had emails from people telling us how valuable they found these sessions, how valuable it's been for them to remain connected, and how wonderful it is that they've been able to, that we've been able to deliver these services in this way. So my advice would be to have a go.
And I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head there, which is stay connected. I think that is the most important thing during this pandemic that everyone is undergoing, staying connected. And you're right, we are frontline staff, and we need to be there to support our patients across the spectrum. And how can therapists get in touch with you if they'd like to ask more questions, get some advice?
Yeah. So just to add to your comment, before I tell you my contact details, so I would say that what we're doing is actually preventative work. You know, if we weren't working with this client group, there's a huge risk that they will, or more of a risk, that they will become the, you know, if we don't work with this client in the community, and they will become the inpatient with COVID. So I think it's really important that we do that. And I can't stress that enough.
I think you're right. Yes, absolutely.
To come back to that topic. But if people would like to get in touch with me, then please do. I actually have a blog, which is called Anna Volkmer's Big PhD Adventure, which you can find via my Twitter. And my Twitter is @Volkmer_Anna. But if you have any questions, you'd like to contact me directly, I'm always happy to field questions and discussions. So you can contact me on my email, which is a.volkmer, V-O-L-K-M for mother, E-R, .15@ucl.ac.uk. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you, Anna. And I will be putting Anna's details on the website, on UK Health Radio's website, with the podcast episode. Thanks, Anna, for coming in again. And I'm sure we can have you, you know, on a lot more sessions discussing different topics, especially for speech therapists that are thinking about going into research. So hopefully we will have you on again.
That would be ace. Thank you, Shamina.